We are rolling. Hi, this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch, speaking with Nicola De Torrente. Hi, Nicola.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So, Nicola, you're with Médecins Sans Frontières, otherwise known as Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. And I'm very pleased to be speaking with you today because, Nicola, on this show I like to talk about global issues, global trends, and one issue that I feel I don't speak on frequently enough, at least, is global health. And Doctors Without Borders put out a report at the end of last year identifying the top 10 humanitarian crises of 2008, and a number of these focused directly on issues of global public health. So I wanted to speak with you a bit about some of these top 10 crises. You know, we don't have enough time to go over all of them, but I urge viewers to go to your website. We'll post a link to the report, and it's actually a really interesting website. It's each of the top 10 issues is very interactive. There are pictures and videos, and I highly encourage readers to check it out. I wanted to start by talking about one issue that you raised. One of the top 10 humanitarian crises of 2008. Is this growing link you write about between HIV and TB? And I was wondering if you could explain that a bit.
Sure. Well, we focus as a medical humanitarian organization on situations where people are really in acute need. And one of these situations for us is what we would term medical catastrophes, situations where a particular disease really overwhelms the capacity of a country, a local ministry of health, and health actors in a specific situation to cope, and has a huge impact on the population, the ordinary people who are living in that situation, in that context. So clearly, HIV/AIDS, as we all know, and we've observed it since the 1990s, is one of those kind of catastrophes that with mortality on a catastrophic scale. Of course, there have been, thankfully, a lot of efforts in recent years to provide, not just to try to prevent transmission of HIV, but also to treat and to provide antiretroviral drugs on a much larger scale than was the case only a few years ago. So it's a very welcome development, obviously. It's saving a lot of lives. One of the things that we've noticed, however, is that people die really when they are HIV positive and they develop AIDS. They die of associated illnesses. They die of other conditions that thrive because the people have the depressed immune system. And tuberculosis is really one of the leading cause of death, actually, for patients with HIV/AIDS in our programs, in the settings that we work in, which are resource-poor settings, which are among poor populations, mainly in Africa, but in other contexts as well. So there's been a real rise and upswing in the number of TB cases among HIV-infected populations in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. Drug-resistant TB, but also increasingly multi-drug resistant TB that is extremely difficult to treat. And this is really posing a major challenge for our doctors in the field because of several things. One is that they really don't have the proper diagnostic tools to detect whether an HIV-positive, an AIDS patient has TB. The test that we rely upon is a sputum test. So you have patients who spit in a cup, and then you analyze that. This test was invented by Robert Koch in 1882. So it's a 19th century invention that we are still continuing to use. It's the most widespread test that we have at our disposal in the field. And in HIV patients, they have a very hard time bringing up the kind of sputum that would actually allow the detection of TB. So huge problem. We can't, we don't, even if testing is made available and only 1% of HIV positive patients actually are tested for TB, the tools that we have to detect are just not, don't do the job. And then you, even if you know the patient has TB, active TB, the treatment is very complicated. The drugs that we have are outdated, they're complicated to use, and they have interactions with the HIV medications, the antiretroviral drugs that the patients are taking. And so this makes the management of the disease extremely complicated and is one of the reasons why the death toll is so high among co-infected HIV-TB patients. So it's a huge problem. It's one that is under-reported, under-noticed. The approaches to these diseases are still basically parallel approaches. You have HIV programs, kind of vertical programs, TB programs, national TB programs. You don't really have an integration of both in these settings. That's a problem, and the tools that we have are very inadequate. So we're really putting the spotlight on it in a hope to attract more attention and also to have more research and development, better tools, better diagnostic tools, and more drugs, better drugs for TB. It's a long-haul effort, but it's one that's really necessary in view of the toll that's being taken by this disease.
In sort of the developed world, where there are sort of presumed, you know, where there are stronger health systems, do you see... I don't know very much about this issue, so I'm wondering, do you see co-infections, say, in the United States or in Canada or in other places with strong health systems? Or is this simply a function of having a weak health system in the developed world?
Yeah, it is really an issue that is happening and a concern that's really emerged in resource-poor settings where the population is poor and where the health systems are weak. It's a similar issue with pediatric cases in HIV, for instance. I mean, fortunately, in the United States, in Europe, we've been able to prevent the transmission of HIV from the mother to the child to a very large extent, and there are only a couple of dozen of cases of kids with HIV in the U.S. for instance a year, new cases. That's not at all the case, obviously, in Africa, where we have not been able yet to really make a significant impact on the prevention of transmission of HIV from mother to child. A lot of programs, a lot of efforts, but I was recently in Zimbabwe. I looked at the programs. I mean, it's very hard to do to prevent this because women don't deliver at the hospital. They don't do the antenatal care is much weaker. They don't do the follow-up visits, and therefore we still have lots and lots of kids who are born HIV positive, and that's a huge issue again because of the similarly to TB, since it's not a big health problem in the U.S. and in Europe. The research and development, it has not been a priority. There hasn't been much effort. There haven't been many resources devoted to that. And so, similarly, there are few new drugs for TB treatment, and there are few appropriate drugs for the treatment of kids with HIV, for pediatric formulations of AIDS, for AIDS patients. So this is what we see, across the board. In fact, in with the patients that we are. That we're dealing with and we're concerned about is that since they're poor, since they're in poor countries, their health needs are not a priority for the research and development efforts of governments and of the pharmaceutical industry. And that's a reality that we have to find a way around. We have to have new incentives and other ways of stimulating R&D for these kinds of conditions. The one that we have for our patients in the developed world is not delivering.
Mm-hmm. I want to sort of follow up with this idea of extremely drug resistant tuberculosis or XDR-TB.
Right.
I assume there's this video. You probably have seen it. This photojournalist James Natchway,
yes.
who made a project out of documenting
sure.
cases of XDR-TB around the world. And it sort of opened my eyes to this and sort of put a human face on this tragedy. But I was wondering if you could explain sort of precisely what that is and why we should be worried about it.
Well, I'm not sure I can do it extremely precisely, but let me give it a shot. I mean, I think there's XDR. There's first drug-resistant TB, which is TB that can be treated with a combination of the four main antibiotics that are used in combination to treat TB. It's a long treatment. Even the short course is 6 months of treatment. Now, there are now the development of strains of TB that are resistant to the key antibiotics among those four. And they are called drug-resistant TB or multi-drug-resistant TB. And then there is a strain of TB that's resistant to everything, which is basically XDR or ultra-resistant TB, I think it's, you know, extra. So it's the XDR TB strain. There's a lot more MDR TB than XDR TB. MDR TB is actually quite prevalent. The estimates are that about 500,000 new cases of MDR, multidrug resistant TB, a year around the world. They're basically due to the failure of drug resistant TB, failure of compliance, failure of adherence. Patients who move, you know, have a drug resistant TB that then transforms into multidrug resistant TB. Or they're actually due now to their multidrug-resistant TB epidemics, where a patient with a multidrug-resistant TB strain will pass it on to another person, particularly within the family. So if you have an MDR TB patient in a home, and TB, that's the same for all TB patients, in fact, they will transmit it by coughing to their sibling or to a spouse inside the home. So we have MDR TB epidemics. The problem with MDR TB is that it's extremely difficult to treat. I mean, it's 18 months of treatment with a few drugs that are available. They're extremely expensive. They're thousands of dollars per treatment course. And they're extremely toxic drugs, lots of side effects. And even if the patient takes the drugs throughout, our success rate in our programs, and it's hard to call it even a success rate, is about 50%. We have programs in the former Soviet Union. We have programs in Armenia. We have programs in Georgia, and we're treating also MDR cases in HIV patients in Africa. And we struggle tremendously to treat this disease. So it is in that sense, it's a huge threat because, you know, even more than TB, as it spreads, we are even more handcuffed and have even less means at our disposal to try to tackle this disease. When I think it was about 2 years ago, a strain of XDR TB was found in South Africa that had a huge mortality rate of 90% of the cases were found in this particular instance. People died. It really sent shockwaves in the medical community, saying, you know, if this goes on and develops and spreads, we really will have a catastrophe in our hands. So far, we don't have the evidence of that, but I think it's a real possibility. At least the medical experts that I've heard discuss this say it's a real possibility.
Well, you know, certainly something to keep an eye on. I wanted to maybe move on to another one of the sort of issues raised in your recent report, and that is of malnourishment among children. Now, you know, that we've had all these food riots in 2008, which, you know, really brought to the fore this issue of scarcity. But you write in the report that the problem of malnourishment is not necessarily the unavailability of foods so much as it is the unavailability of right foods. I was wondering if you could explain this issue.
Sure. It's the issue of malnutrition, and we're most concerned about the issue of malnutrition among young children because they are the ones who are most susceptible to it, most vulnerable. They are the ones who die the most of malnutrition. We do see malnutrition in adults in rare cases, but it's really in cases of a real famine. We've seen that in Somalia in 1992, for instance, at the height of the famine, or in South Sudan. But usually the real problem is malnutrition among young kids, acute malnutrition. And malnutrition is really a life-threatening condition. It contributes to about half of all of the deaths of children under five around the world. So UNICEF estimates there are just between 9 and 10 million kids under five who die every year around the world. Of course, the vast majority in developing countries, and about half are linked, of these deaths are linked to malnutrition. So it's a big problem, obviously. The It's about 180 million kids who suffer from malnutrition at any given time around the world. So it's a big issue. It's mainly due to the fact that the incidence of malnutrition, the number of cases, and the severity of it is really concentrated in a few areas. And these are, in fact, contrary to some of the, you know, what we might expect. It's not really in the big urban centers and the big cities. It's really in rural areas and in extremely poor rural areas. So it's in the Sahel region of Africa, in West Africa, so in Niger, in Burkina Faso, in northern Nigeria. It's in Ethiopia, where there was a big emergency this year. And it's in Southeast Asia, in India, which has by far the highest number of cases, in Pakistan and Bangladesh. And basically what you have is you have families of very poor farmers who are unable to feed, to provide to their children the kind of varied diet, the nutritious foods that young kids need to grow and thrive. And it's they need energy, of course, but it's really, as you pointed out in the beginning, it's the quality of food that counts. And that means they need protein, they need really an animal source protein, a milk or an egg or meat. And those foods are really out of reach for very, very poor families in these rural areas that often have a lot of children, where there's a succession of kids, one after the other. And so in this critical window of 6 months to 2 to 3 years of age, they are not able to feed these kids the appropriate diet, and that leads to preventable deaths in large numbers. This is a big problem. It's also something that I think, and this is why we're highlighting it, because I think it's something we can really do something about, this massive toll. There are new approaches, there are new foods that can be used, supplements really, that can be given to kids that have been developed that are in the form of pastes, where you have a peanut-based paste, for instance, that has also the milk powder, so it has the protein that the kids need. It has all the micronutrients that kids need. We've learned a lot about the importance of having the full the full range of micronutrients. It has the vitamins. It has everything that a young kid suffering from malnutrition really needs to recover from that and to grow and to thrive. And so these are these pastes. They're called ready-to-use foods that we've been using on a large scale now in some of these malnutrition hotspots. And we're able to reach, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids with these pastes, and with even kids who are severely malnourished, who are really, where it's a really life-threatening condition where, you know, they could die, up to 50% of them could die within 2-3 weeks if they don't get appropriate treatment. We can save 90% of those kids. And so it can make a huge impact on a large scale.
What's preventing the distribution of these pastes on a large scale?
But the advantage of them is that they don't need to be cooked. They don't need to be mixed with water, which is often a problem with contamination. If water is unsanitary, you have diarrhea. So they don't need to be cooked, and they don't need to be refrigerated for storage. So, and a lot of them can be produced locally. So as this has been catching on now, and the World Health Organization and UNICEF and the World Food Program are now recommending these pastes for the treatment of severe acute malnutrition. They are now increasingly produced locally, so you have factories in Niger, in Ethiopia, and Malawi that produce these pastes. So it can be, you know, there is a potential here of reaching far more kids than we have at the present. And we also can prevent malnutrition, I think. This is also the great idea to, you know, modify some of these pastes and distribute them on a large scale to all kids, perhaps, who are at risk of malnutrition in a given area, because we know it's going to come back over and over, year after year. These kids are going to become malnourished instead of waiting for them to reach a critical stage to start to distribute the supplement they need, and then to prevent them from becoming malnourished. So what is required? I think it's a policy change, so we're starting to see that happening. And then it's a change in at least for the areas that are receiving food aid at the moment. It's a change in food aid. It's a reform of food aid. To take the U.S., for example, I mean, the U.S. Provides supplements for moderately malnourished kids, for these children, but the supplements that are being provided today are basically fortified flours, corn-based, corn-soy blends, and so on. which are really not as effective as these pastes. And, you know, there's a double standard, because we would never give these kinds of fortified flowers to kids here in the United States, although the needs of a young growing kid here in a poor area in the U.S. is exactly the same as the needs of a young growing kid in Ethiopia, for instance. So we need to change, reform U.S. food aid. It's a big problem. It's a big issue to reform U.S. food aid. There are lots of interests involved. There are the, you know, the farmers who grow these foods, the shipping companies that are paid to ship the food, the in-kind donations overseas, and so those interests will have to be addressed. But I think if we replaced CSB, this corn soya blend that is being distributed today, with ready-to-use foods and distributed those instead, I think there could be a major impact on childhood mortality, which again is you know, is a big goal that all governments have, their Millennium Development Goals and so on, which no one is reaching, and this could be a big I think a big way to make an impact in that direction.
Is the United States one of the bigger food donors in the world?
Yes, the United States is the largest single food aid donor in the world. It has its the peculiarity of it is that it is in kind. It donates food in kind, so it donates corn, and it donates wheat, and so on, oil in kind, and the food then is shipped on U.S. Flag carriers overseas on by boats, basically to the places where the food is needed. So it's
how does that? I'm just curious. How does that different from, say, how like Western Europe countries do their food?
Yeah, the Western European countries have moved away from in-kind donations and are giving cash to basically the big food aid agency, which is the World Food Program. And the World Food Program then purchases food, because, in fact, a lot of the food can be purchased in Africa. Supply. It's the kind of the irony, actually a great thing. I mean, you can buy food in Kenya and Uganda, and ship it. Of course, it's much cheaper. It stimulates local agriculture, and then you can ship it to the Eastern Democratic part of the Democratic Republic of Congo now, where people are displaced on the run and need food aid because they are in camps as a result of the conflict there. Instead of shipping it from the United States, which of course is much more expensive and much more inefficient. So, the World Food Program now is really, you know, I think about 80% of its requirements are now purchased locally, and it's much more effective. They get much more value for the dollar in contribution when it's given to them in cash. But because of political reasons and the farm bill which was passed and the food aid system was not changed in the U.S. Last year, it's still in-kind contributions from the U.S.
I'd be actually interested to see how the next administration approaches that issue. I mean, it's not... You know, I suppose it's sort of in aid communities, it's something you hear about a lot, but it's not sort of something I think resonates. You know, I'm talking to you here in D.C., and it's not something that sort of is talked about very frequently. Is sort mm-hmm. of how we do our food aid and how it might be improved. But that's I think a really interesting topic to probe further. I wanted to maybe move on and talk about another. So. In addition to sort of these thematic areas like HIV, tuberculosis, connection, and child malnourishment, the report also looks at sort of some region and country-specific sort of hotspots, and one of which is another topic I don't get into so frequently on this program, which is Pakistan, specifically Western Pakistan, Northwest Pakistan, which is a sort of a, you know, sort of a big conflict region, but which is also relatedly the site of a pretty dire humanitarian crisis. And I wondered if you could maybe set the scene for us.
Sure. I mean, the list that we've compiled, which is really the top 10 with humanitarian crises of 2008, you know, we do it on the basis of the experience of our field teams who are trying to provide assistance in places that where people are really affected by conflict and other kind of crisis and catastrophes, and we mentioned some of these medical crises earlier on. So the ours is really the humanitarian perspective. So it's the perspective of people who are going through these crises and how they're coping and how they're dealing with it and how it's affecting them and how we're able to help them. And so for us, the situation in Pakistan is one of these areas that has really risen in last year in terms of its severity, its scope, its magnitude. The escalation of the conflict in the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan, between on the one hand the Pakistan government, and on the other hand a range of anti-government militants. And add onto that the issue of the U.S. Airstrikes against suspected or accused al-Qaeda and militants who are in this area. That has really had a pretty big impact, which we don't hear very much about since the focus is a lot in the media on the military operations, but really a big impact on the population who's living in this area and who's kind of caught in this conflict. There are aerial strikes, there are ground operations, there are suicide bombings, and this has led upwards of 300,000 people in a few of these different areas. And it's a complex area, and each area within the Northwest Frontier Province and Northwest Frontier area, there are lots of different kind of sub-regions and sub-areas. But in some of these, we've had 300,000 people flee. And they flee to areas where that they think are safer, so down in valleys to regional centers. We've had many of them come into Peshawar, the big city in the capital city of the Northwest Frontier Province. Many of them stay with host families, so they are accommodated by family members or relatives and so on. But we've also had camps crop up. We've had schools and mosques being used for people to shelter. And we've also had people actually flee all back into Afghanistan or into Afghanistan from Pakistan. So we have Pakistani refugees in Afghanistan, which is really a kind of an ironic development when you know how many Afghans fled into Pakistan over the years since the 1980s and have used Pakistan as a refuge. To see Pakistanis go the other way is kind of ironic. So this is a very worrisome situation. It's also worrisome because it's very hard for aid agencies to work in this area. The suspicion level that we see in all conflict zones when we have, foreign groups who come in like ours and say, we're here to help, we're here to provide humanitarian assistance, there's a natural suspicion of, what the motives are, who, what the purpose of the presence is. And a lot of our work is to try to really convince and explain that we are there just for the humanitarian purpose, the medical purpose. We have no hidden agenda, no other agenda, no political, economic, and so agenda, religious agenda. And of course, that's these are concepts that are kind of difficult in especially in places like this that have not seen many foreigners, have not had external agencies being present there. We were, of course, present there during the big earthquake in Pakistan, and that has helped us, I think, to some extent. But aid workers have been attacked, have been targeted, have been killed, have been kidnapped in this area. Something that we've also seen happen, of course, a lot in Afghanistan. So, in fact, in a way, there's a bit of a merging of the two contexts between and some of the similar dynamics that we've seen in Pakistan and Afghanistan now are being carried over to Pakistan. So it's a very difficult place for us to work, but we are helping the internally displaced. We are providing ambulance service for war wounded in this area, and it's an area that I think we need to keep a close eye on.
Now, another, and this will probably be the final topic we get into, and I'll let viewers go to your website and read up on the remaining issues. Is Myanmar, sort of post cyclone Nargis Myanmar? I'm wondering, Do you describe a situation in Pakistan where there seems to be a high level of mistrust between the local population and aid workers, and I'm wondering if that dynamic also exists in Myanmar.
Well, in Pakistan, I think the just to come back to it, I think the issue that is really the mistrust or the confidence building that's required, let's say, between the aid organizations and and not just so much the local population, but really the figures of authority and political and military leaders. I think that's where the issue is more pronounced. And in a way, that's what we see around the world. I mean, I think yes, there are issues of confidence building with local communities, and there's work to be done there. But the main problems we have in delivering assistance, in being blocked from delivering aid, from accessing a place, or encountering security risks and attacks, really stem from the actions and attitudes of political and military leaders. And just in the case of Myanmar, it's really a bit of a different situation. I mean, as you know, I mean, the situation there is we have an authoritarian regime, a reclusive regime that is trying to exert control over its country. And is as well suspicious of outside influence that they see as potentially undermining their hold on power, and that's what we saw during the Nargis cyclone, where the government was reluctant to let aid organizations come into the country and provide assistance. We were in a bit of a different position as Doctors Without Borders. We have had extensive operations programs inside Myanmar for years. We have a massive AIDS project in the country, and that gave us a leg up in the sense that we had local staff members on the ground who could then go into the Irrawaddy Delta and provide assistance in the immediate aftermath of the cyclone. But yes, there is this suspicion and this kind of reluctance vis-a-vis international aid groups. The big issue that we're facing with in Myanmar really is this kind of selective blindness to needs there, and the neglect, really the utter neglect displayed by the government towards the health needs of its population. So, you have a government that wants to be in complete control, and on the other hand, who really doesn't care much about what the local population, the population under its authority, is experiencing in terms of, in particular in terms of health concerns. And so there's no investment in public services and health services, and so you have, far greater than you should expect incidence of HIV/AIDS and impact of HIV/AIDS in the country, and hardly any treatment available. I mean, as a non-governmental organization there, we provide 80% of all of the AIDS treatment available in Myanmar, which is really quite stunning when you think about it. A private aid group doing that. So people there's just a neglect of the health needs of the population by the government, and something that is having big consequences.
Do you know how many offhand how many HIV patients you treat in Myanmar?
We have about 11,000 patients on antiretroviral therapy in Myanmar. It's estimated that about 75,000 would require antiretroviral treatment, and about 25,000 people died of HIV/AIDS last year. So, we're 80% of a 20% coverage, if you will. So it's really quite minimal.
I'm fascinated by it. Is that MSF exclusively, or is that all aid groups?
No, that's just one aid group. That's just MSF. So
just MSF. Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah. So it's these are when you have a government that really doesn't invest, they devote a minuscule fraction of their resources to health needs. You have malaria making a huge impact, and you have areas of the country where there's an area of the country in Myanmar in the western part, in the border with Bangladesh, where the population is Muslim. The Rakhine in Rakhine state, the Rohingya population, they're not even considered as citizens of Myanmar. They are, they're stateless, basically, within their own country, which shows, the degree to which their basic health needs, not just health needs, their basic needs as human beings are being neglected by the government. So this is the paradox. I mean, on the one hand, they want to control everything. On the other hand, they neglect their population.
And I guess finally, just to wrap things up, looking forward to 2009, are there any issues that we should keep our eyes open for? Anything in particular that you think we should look out and sort of pay attention to?
Well, I mean, there's some of these these situations, these conflicts in particular, are really enduring. They're long-standing. They're very entrenched. I think they will definitely, their impact on people, on populations will continue throughout 2009. In particular, the situation in Sudan, in Darfur, but also in southern Sudan, which is on our list. And again, I'm not going to go into detail, but please go to our website. We have lots of information about it. But that will continue, no doubt. The Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as well. It's been on our list basically. We've had this list for about 10 years, and it's been on our list every single year. So there are lulls. We sometimes think it's going to get better. There are peace deals. There were elections a few years ago. But, the situation in 2008 was a war that reignited in the eastern part of the Congo. Somalia, which I wish we could have talked about a bit more, but again, our website has lots of information there. You know, it's quite a catastrophic situation, really, in the last 2 years. With heightened international involvement, an Ethiopian military invasion to prop up and install an internationally backed government in Somalia, in Mogadishu, to change the regime that had been installed there, that had emerged there, which was an Islamic the Islamic Courts Union, and which was viewed as unacceptable. So they were ousted 2 years ago, and in fact. That, in fact, spawned a very, very vicious and brutal war in Somalia and displaced hundreds of thousands and further destroyed the capital, Mogadishu. So that will, the Ethiopians have announced their withdrawal now, and this is taking place in January right now. But no doubt that the conflict will continue and the impact will continue to be great. And finally, Zimbabwe, these are, we are dealing with the human consequences of political decisions and political choices and political failures. And I think Zimbabwe illustrates that to a great degree. We have a big cholera epidemic that we're battling today, which when you know how the infrastructure of Zimbabwe was only 10 years ago, I mean, they just can't provide the chlorine for their water treatment plants. They can't maintain their water and sanitation system, and we have something that's unheard of in Zimbabwe, a cholera epidemic as a result, again, as a result of real political failure. So that situation is likely to continue in 2009.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'll check back with you at some point over the course of the year to take stock of where these issues stand. But for now, thank you very much, Nicolas.